You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, a weekly series that brings you exclusive, in-depth conversations with some of the most interesting and exciting figures in hip-hop. We're brought to you by RapGenius.com, your source on the internet for decoding, annotating, and analyzing rap lyrics. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we talk to one of the foremost thinkers in hip-hop, Professor Trisha Rose. Rose, who teaches at Brown University, is the author of two seminal books about rap. The first, Black Noise, Rap Music and Black Culture in Contemporary America, was published in 1994 and was the first book-length scholarly work about hip-hop. Its extremely influential ideas helped create a framework for writing and thinking about this still new music. Professor Rose's 2008 book, The Hip-Hop Wars, What We Talk About When We Talk About Hip-Hop and Why It Matters, was a critique of the music she loved, which she argued had been warped by corporate influence. Rose continues to write and speak about hip-hop and other topics, in addition to her teaching duties. She recently appeared at the Google-sponsored debate Hip-Hop on Trial, along with Michael Eric Dyson, Torre, Questlove, Slaughterhouse, and more. We reached Professor Rose by phone at her office in Providence and began by talking about her trailblazing ways.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to me. I really appreciate it.
Sure. No, I'm happy to do it. I appreciate Rap Genius a lot. I didn't realize it was started by an actual Yalie, which I'm also one. I didn't know that at the time. I had knew about it before you contacted me and used it in my class more than once.
Wow, that's incredible.
it's a small world. No, there's very few sites that do what it does. So I told students they were going to go try to figure out lyrics on the web. They should start with Rap Genius. So that was the place to begin, not with, you know, lyrics360.com.
Wow, thank you so much. I wanted to just start off by asking a little bit about you. I know that a couple of your books were kind of first in their fields. Longing to Tell was really the first oral history of kind of sexual histories of women of color, and going a bit further back, Black Noise was, as far as I know, and you can certainly correct me, but I think was like the first scholarly work about rap. Like, what makes you kind of keep going off into these uncharted territories? Most of the academics I deal with kind of find one little niche and burrow into it for...
Yeah, that is a very good observation of academic life. So let me before I answer my direct motivations there, let me first say that, you know, I think there was, say, a dissertation that either had a couple of chapters on hip hop before Black Noise, but Black Noise was certainly widely considered the most sustained, serious, and published full-length text on hip-hop. So, the question whether or not it's the absolute first is, you know, something that others have wanted to discuss, because I think, you know, they may not be happy with
sure.
the status of their own work.
If there's one thing I've learned from reading and writing about music, it's just saying the first anything is
it's exactly. But it's certainly, I think, it's easy to say that it is the earliest, most well-respected, widely cited text. And in some ways, I think it still stands apart from a lot of what's been published. So, I mean, I certainly don't have any negative feelings about my own work. I might do it differently today, I suppose, so many years later, some pieces of it. But It definitely was a trailblazing project, and it was, I mean, the actual trailblazing nature of it is much more elaborate than it looks like, because one of the things that scholars and students and fans of hip-hop take for granted today is that there's a language, a culture, a discursive framework, to use an academic phrase, for the study and reflection on the music, and it simply did not exist when I was researching Black Noise. It just didn't exist. So there was no one really to advise me directly on the subject, as you would have today in many, many places. There were only journalistic accounts published, and, you know, Houston Baker's book, which was sort of about the conversation about hip-hop or rap, as it was called more often at the time. So it was very much uncharted territory, and, you know, I think that's really important, not to, you know, brag or anything in that sense, but more to say it's very important to continue to do that kind of work today. That is to say, to go out on these limbs and really pursue uncharted territory in intellectual work, particularly people of color, poor people, immigrants, people whose stories never get the light of day, and their new creations are often absconded with by markets, by corporations, by history, by lack of respect. So I would really, my interest in that comes from the concern that we get so comfortable, not just academics, but journalists and pop culture people, sort of advancing our careers rather than thinking about what's at stake and who, you know, what are the cultural outcomes of continuing to talk about the same thing when so much else new is going on and is seriously in need of our attention.
Excellent. Well, in Black Noise, you had some really great ideas about rap authorship, right? This intense pride in writing your own rhymes and not biting others' work, but that, the references and the lyrics and the samples rely on collective memory and associations. Do you think were there any other real precedents in popular culture for this kind of mix of, like, individual and collective writing?
Yeah, and I mean, there's a huge precedent. Pretty much the whole history of Black music is the precedent. Not to be glib, but, you know, the blues does it all the time. Jazz instrumental solos did it all the time. It is actually an African diasporic or Afro-diasporic, depending on, you know, who you ask. Great to use this very interesting combination of individual and collective narrative, identity, language, and definitions of creativity and originality. So what made it so different in hip-hop was that it was using the technology to do this quote-unquote citation, as it were, to do this collective reference. And once you cite corporate objects, e.g. records, right, now you bring on the wrath of the industry, and that's really what makes for the distinction. It's not the technique entirely. Of course, it's newly formed inside the context of new technology, but it's the formation itself has tremendous legacies and histories that are pretty common in African-American culture.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't even thought about it in that context, but you're right. All bebop is, you know, I got changes with a different melody and faster.
Sort of. That's not all it is.
That's one of the things.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it changes. I mean, it's a really amazing cultural process. And this is a really important thing that I wish we talked more about, not just in hip-hop, but about culture, is that the way you create shapes a consciousness about the community you're in. Mm-hmm. So the way you create and what you value and how you identify those values and how you reinforce them actually shapes community. So one of the most beautiful things about the very point you raised that I mentioned in Black Noise, but that we're both saying has this long precedent, is that it doesn't deny the role of individual creativity, but it doesn't elevate it into a kind of iconic me first, I'm the baddest of all time, uninterrupted by anybody else ever consciousness, which is a very dangerous one socially and politically. So it finds a way to carve out an incredible level of individuality in the context of a collective, larger, good/larger community. And it's in a kind of dialogical relationship to to that community all the time. And that's a very powerful social matter. It's not just the sort of artistic matter in the abstract. It's a social phenomenon that's, I think, incredibly important to hold on to.
Okay. Now, following up on that idea of, you know, collective consciousness and you know, collective writing, you talked about in an interview, you talked about how glad you were that you had what you call the pre-hip-hop consciousness, basically that at least some of your childhood had taken place before rap was around. And I know when I talk to veteran rappers, they have that same thing. You know, the music of their childhood is soul and disco and pop, you know, because there was no hip-hop. And I guess I'm wondering what you think is lost when artists today grow up knowing only hip-hop and not having, literally not having any consciousness of a world before hip-hop.
Man, these questions are like, I mean, I'm trying desperately not to answer like them 30 minutes at a time, but this is yet another 30-minute question, Sean. So here it is in like hopefully less than 2 minutes. I mean, first of all, the problem is not just that it's hip-hop in the abstract is the problem for young consumers today or young listeners. It's that the whole history of the community of Black musical creation has been erased from the collective space of Black consumption. So when I was a teenager before hip-hop, and sort of it happened during my teenage years, so there's a pre-teenage and a post-teenage sort of hip-hop experience for me. But before that, and really my whole childhood, because hip-hop didn't take over the radio for a long, long time, but you would hear, you know, gospel, blues, R&B, soul, disco, funk, jazz on what was then legitimately Black radio. And you would hear it all the time. So the full spectrum of African diasporic music. You heard reggae, right? You heard calypso in New York, of course, right? Maybe not everywhere. But so this idea that there was a rich creative space was possible. Now, you know, the reasons why that shifts is really the subject of my second book on hip-hop, Hip-Hop Wars, which is that hip-hop becomes such a profitable product that it eclipses the rich terrain of music. So you have something like jazz, which although it is, of course, a global phenomenon, is a gift of African Americans to the modern world. That is the community that gives it to the world. And yet, nobody Black can find any jazz on the radio in any reasonable Black context. Right? It's just virtually impossible. So it's not for sale to a dominant society. The idea of it being worthy of circulation has gone away. So that's the major, I think, loss that this generation of musical, pop musical Black consumers are facing. That rich range of options is just almost impossible and so uncelebrated that it's not cool enough to bother listening.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And speaking of the rich range of things and how it's been narrowed, you know, Hip Hop Wars talks a bit about congealing and a narrowing of acceptable images in hip hop. You know, and this was an idea that really struck me. It used to be much wider and sort of the golden age, and now is much narrower. Although it seems to me over the past maybe 6 or 7 years, like that's been starting to reverse a little bit. The success of Kanye West, for example, seems to me a real harbinger of that. Do you see this kind of narrowing of personas from a million different things to just, you know, the player pimpo thing starting to expand again at all?
Well, I mean, I keep hearing that, right? I keep hearing that re-expansion as a narrative, and I certainly don't think it's permanently set in stone. I hope it can change. But what I mostly see replacing the gangster pimpo trinity is the luxury consumption gangster. Mm-hmm. So what generally happens is, you know, you might have a little bit less explicit language among the elite of sort of commercially popular hip-hop. You might have less discussion of the traditional, you know, kill each other, sell drugs, you know, get some bitches and hoes type of talk. And but what it's been replaced with is a litany of consumer goods, for the most part, as the primary means by which status and value is determined. So what's really happened is, in my mind, is a kind of consciousness takeover, which is to say that the internalization of consumer capitalism, as expressed by the incredible artistry and genius of many hip-hop artists, is to me eroding the very spirit we started, we're talking about at the outset, which is me and you together in community. You know, consumer capitalism at the level that we're being asked to participate in it is incredibly violent and incredibly spiritually draining and community destroying. And that's not hip-hop's fault by any stretch. It's just really more of a victim than anything else. But if participating in it and those who choose to critique it are put out as if they're somehow anti-hip-hop, rather than being seen as people who are, you know, giving out a warning about, hey, you know, this could destroy both hip-hop and people of color and poor people and everybody in the world who might want to have a more just environment. So I don't think it's permanent. I don't think the gangster pimp opportunity is permanent, but I think the space that created that drive and that commercial value, the celebration of a certain kind of black dysfunction as a major consumption point, yeah, is still in play and hasn't fundamentally changed. I long for that day. I will be celebrating in the streets, but I'm not going to call it just because there's some shifts in the market across 3 years.
Mm-hmm. I hear that. And it was funny, too, speaking of people's reaction to that, on the hip-hop debate there, I saw Joe Budden from Slaughterhouse get uncomfortable for reasons he really couldn't even seem to articulate. And I'm quite a big fan of his, but, you know, in your back and forth there, he seemed to... you know, when issues were sexism were raised, he seemed to get really uncomfortable and kind of start crawling in his skin for reasons that I don't think he even necessarily could fully articulate. I was wondering how you felt at that moment when you kind of saw him react like that.
Well, you know, to be honest, you know, I don't like being in an antagonistic relationship with artists over these issues. I don't. And, you know, I'm sorry that they picked someone who has thought as little about this as he apparently had, right? Because, I mean, I'm assuming if he thought a lot about it, he probably would have had more to say. He's not a person who doesn't know how to speak, right? So I think the discomfort comes from maybe not having to have thought this through, which is, of course, a symptom of the very thing I'm talking about, right? There's no interrogation. There's no challenge. There's no public sphere. It's just market, market, market. You sell and you're protected, right? And you never have to be confronted with this potential challenge. So I'm not happy about that. I mean, I don't think he's particularly to blame, but he's emblematic of a broader phenomenon. And that's why I was very careful to point out that the audience's, you know, gales of laughter and entertainment, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that they were entertained by his response is the core of the problem.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, his success is impossible without that complicitness. So I was trying to hold everybody accountable, but I also fundamentally wanted to say that his speech, his narrative is indefensible, and he should be challenged for that in a loving way, in a careful way, but also in a way that is, you know, indicating the level of injury that position can cause, you know? So it's a delicate thing for me because, you know, he's really not, it's sort of like he's the front face of a much bigger apparatus, and everybody wants to disappear and be unaccountable. Everybody, the industry, the consumers, the journalists, some of the academics, you know, obviously the corporate executives, everybody, nobody wants to be accountable.
Right.
Nobody wants to justify what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so it's not fair just to blame him.
Sure. Something about hip-hop artists that I've long noticed, but I think you're the only person I've ever seen talk about it. In the Hip-Hop Wars, you wrote about the dual image of rap celebrities, that they have, you know, as you put it, a cuddly, friendly side, and then this side that maintains street credibility. And I first noticed this when I went to see Snoop Dogg perform, and he came out and did all his hits that everybody loves while dressed in a giant blue bandana, which, you know, of course, is a big Crip signifier. So, you know, he remains funny and goofy and around kids and then reps the street gang openly at every possible opportunity. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about how that double image developed and what interests both sides of the equation, the artists and the corporations, have in maintaining it.
Yeah, that's a great question, Sean. And you know, it's funny because one of the first times I remember seeing it was with Snoop Dogg, too. I don't know if we both caught the same moment in time or if we're both late, maybe it was earlier. But I remember when he did that TV commercial with Lee Iacocca.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even remember if it was an auto product or they were both doing a commercial for another product. They were on a golf course. And, you know, it was like, wow, so Snoop is somehow a... you know, comedic, cuddly figure all of a sudden. How did this happen? And he was still, you know, in the same time period, he was still dragging, you know, women to the MTV Music Awards on leashes. And, you know, so there was a contradiction, apparently. And I think part of it is just the incredible facility that marketing genius really has been able to pull off by creating these niches that don't overlap unless you pursue them to overlap. So if you're a big, deep hip-hop fan of Snoop Dogg, you're going to know his gangster profile, and you're not likely to be upset about it, obviously, if you're a big fan of his. Now, when he goes the Lee Iacocca route, just to use that as a, you know, a reference point, he is now becoming sort of a cuddly, radio-friendly, almost a radio edit version for the parents, for people who just don't pay attention to hip-hop but have heard of him. They want to be cool. He's charming. He's funny, you know, and he sort of gets this other icon to work with, and it gives him much more commercial viability. I mean, his Q rating has to expand dramatically for that, because, you know, hip-hop's market is for the real, truly hardcore, is just smaller, right? So everybody wants the biggest market. Same thing's been true for Lil Wayne. I have to tell you this quick story. I was at my office one day, and my husband said, you know, look, you got to come down to the Dunk, you know, here in Providence. There's a big Lil Wayne concert, and you have to come see the people outside, you know, waiting to get in. I'm like, honey, you know, I have a few more minutes. You're going to really trust me. You're really going to want to. I'm like, okay. So I always, whenever he says that, I'm like, okay, this must be serious. So I go running down there, and the entire front of this arena, which is a medium size because Providence is not that big, but it's big enough, is filled with 11-year-old white girls. Thousands, accompanied by parents, to go see Lil Wayne, whose biggest hit, Lick Me Like a Lollipop, is on the radio at the time.
Right.
And I'm standing out there thinking, how did this happen? You know, look, it's a great hook, and, you know, it's a catchy song, and, you know, it's not about Lil Wayne, it's about how did he get this persona that would allow parents to see him as this cuddly gangster, you know, damn near sexual offender.
Right.
You know, I mean, when you put it in the context of an 11-year-old audience.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't just a few, Sean. It was hundreds of them. Cross-racial, you know, 11, 10, 9, 15, not 25, 35, 40.
Right.
So,
which, given his age and his recording history, is who you might expect to turn out.
Yes, so he clearly has been able to tap into this younger audience, and the reasons for that have everything to do with longevity, consumption. That's the primary consumer that all of these markets, they're always looking for. So, you know, it's a real serious issue, because this is the new cultural norm. The mainstream of consumer capitalism is where people go to get their mainstream sense of their cultural space. It's nowhere near as niche-oriented and off to the side as it used to be.
We'll be right back with the second half of our conversation with writer and academic, Professor Tricia Rose. Welcome back to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. We continued our conversation with Tricia Rose by talking to her about Dr. Dre's 1990 assault on television host Dee Barnes, an incident she wrote about extensively in Black Noise.
Jumping back to Black Noise for a second, you spent a lot of time in there on the Dee Barnes assault and the hip-hop community's lack of response to it. And so how did you, I don't even know if you heard the song, but on the first Eminem album, there's a song that kind of makes light of that. I don't even know if you were aware.
No, I don't know. I don't know. What's the name of that song?
It is Guilty Conscience, and
it's kind
of Eminem and Dr. Dre are the devil. Dre is the angel, and Eminem is the devil on each people's shoulders and in various situations. And on the final one, you know, the person is, you know, contemplating shooting his wife, and Dre says, no, don't do it. And, you know, at a certain point, Eminem says, how are you going to take, you know, are you going to take advice from someone who slapped Dee Barnes? And, you know, that makes Dre angry and finally says, okay, well, go ahead and shoot him. Well, I guess I kind of shoots the question, but I mean, that's a more or less approximation of what happens. I mean, what do you think that I mean, how does that, you know, turning into a joke, you know, 5-6 years later, or maybe, you know, 8-9 years later, what do you think that means? Like, what is that?
I mean, you know, look, this is certainly the catch-22, and I have to say this for your, I'm sure, diverse and brilliant podcast listening audience, that, you know, every time we focus in on one case, you know, someone like me can easily be accused of, you know, attacking Dr. Dre, attacking Slaughterhouse, Eminem, Snoop, Wayne, and that, I just want to say very quickly that this is really about a cultural space that we have anointed and accepted, and we have to challenge it collectively. That said, sometimes that means you have to focus on an example to make the point. But the example is not the point itself. The point is the point. So, in this case, you know, this was a very devastating thing. Dee Barnes is literally afraid for her life. And I met with her and spoke with her at that point. And there were a group of people who were trying to, myself included, and I was still a graduate student at the time, trying to get the more progressive and visible artists to stand up, and not just on her behalf alone, but to say that, you know, this should be unacceptable. Journalists cannot be threatened. Young women shouldn't be threatened. No one should be threatened. This was really in the transition from what people call now the golden era into, you know, the more sort of rampant, you know, public violence that places like the Source seem to be the home of for a while, you know, where, you know, a bad review could result in a, you know, at least a threat of a beatdown. This is right before that. And I think that, you know, hip hop should have responded, the best and brightest in it should have really responded in a way that gave people a choice. It wasn't just be down with this or get out of hip hop, but that there's more than one hip hop. And I think people should have staked a claim to that, but unfortunately they didn't. And I think those urges, those adolescent, you know, often tragically dysfunctional kinds of masculinity, you know, where everything is settled by violence, where slights are exaggerated, sometimes for understandable reasons, but nonetheless, that there's no alternative to that that is legitimate within the generation, so that it just took off like wildfire. And of course, there's all these structural forces, Sean, that created it, right? I mean, you're looking at incarceration, you're looking at horrible police brutality, you're looking at the generation of older men who've been put out of the community, you know, you're looking at unemployment rates at levels of third world countries. You know, we could be here all day with very good reasons that are outside of the individual.
Sure.
But the culture has to take care of itself too, right? It can't just be the context justifies everything. And that's critical. We can say, well, look, this is, we know why this contributes, but that doesn't mean it's okay. So we can say, this is, you know, why this is happening, but that all that means is that we have to work harder to make sure we don't let that change who we are. That doesn't mean we then say, oh, okay, well, you know, you got to beat up bitches and beat them up. You know, I guess that's what we got to do. I mean, it's absurd, right? But somehow here we are. Here we are with virtually no one having anything to say when an MC says something like that.
I just wanted to ask you something. I saw a series of tweets from about, you know, lyrical content in rap from Talib Kweli, who I know you think highly of and mentioned in your book and stuff. I thought they were really interesting. He basically, the subject of them was, he was saying that a lot of people who complain about the lyrical content of today's rap, oh, it's just about strippers and, you know, bitches and hoes and violence or whatever, that what they're really objecting to is the sound, that it doesn't sound like the hip-hop they remember. It doesn't have that early 90s boom-bap sound. And when artists from that era said those same kinds of things, you know, no one, you know, these same people wouldn't have a problem with, you know, what Redman says, but then if the Ying Yang twins say it, you know, all of a sudden it's a huge problem. And I just wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not one to argue with Talib. You know, I mean, he certainly has an insight level that is incredibly important and much more grounded and embedded than mine. So I will defer to him generally, but I'll tell you what, I do hold a different opinion. I mean, I think it's certainly the sound of the music has changed, and that does often put some generations off and some age groups off. And then there's regional sounds, right? Not just generational, but regional. You know, New Yorkers are not big on Dirty South, right, you know, types of beats. And that's true even in the same calendar year, let alone a decade earlier. But at the same time, I think that, number one, I was offended by Redman. Doesn't matter about the bees back in the day. But I also find some of those lyrics creative. That's how we get sucked in, right? So you listen to some of it and you think, oh my God, that was such a creative form of assault. Wow.
Yeah.
You know? Dang, you're jacking me with such genius. Thanks. You know? So there's this kind of crazy contradiction, this complicitness we're asked to participate in. And I think that is a little bit less developed. I think, you know, the Yin Yang Twins are not exactly lyrical geniuses.
Right.
So part of it is the quality of the rhyme. And that's why Lil Wayne is actually really gifted, in my opinion, at that very thing, to take something that should really, you know, if he could use that gift for something else, I'd be thrilled. But unfortunately, more often than not always, but more often than not, he uses it for the very same types of narrative. So for me, it's about the quality of the rhyme,
mm-hmm,
and the diversity of other narratives. So it's about the predominance of that now. You know, everyone, when students say to me, well, what do you want, you know, Professor Rose, you know, what do you want, a purist thing? I said, look, yeah, you got to curse. Sometimes you got to insult people. Sometimes you got to use, I mean, of course, you want the full palette at your disposal and in your repertoire as an artist, as a person, as a thinker. But do you feel like you have a full palette?
Right.
What you have is a couple of colors on this thing. And the most disturbing thing about it is that it's not even acknowledged that somehow this is where your freedom lies. Your freedom lies with insulting each other, with, you know, incredibly aggressive language. This is the equivalent of your freedom, of debasing one another. I mean, it's absurd, right? Now, you don't, I say, look, let's go with 20%. People say, well, let's say 20%. I'll go with 20. 20% gangsters, pimps, hoes, bitches, niggers, killing each other for whatever, getting out of jail, you know, whatever it is you want, 20%. Sometimes I go to 25. Is that enough? Like, that's my feeling about it, right? So then 75% of the time, let's talk about something else.
Mm-hmm.
That's my reading of it. It's not so much a beat thing. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I would stand corrected if I had a chance to talk to, you know, Talib.
Right.
I mean, that's what I take very seriously.
Right. Someone else I had a little more direct interaction with a week or two ago was 50 Cent. And he told me something that he's often said in interviews, which I think you might find interesting, which is, to him, explicitly, gangster rap form serves as a sort of tourism. Sometimes in interviews, he's called it a safari for, you know, his audiences so that they can get sort of the thrill and the danger of the ghetto and not be at any real risk. And I guess, obviously, you're aware of this dynamic, you know, and you've written about it. My question is, why do you think artists who are, you know, obviously explicitly aware of this find it unproblematic, or tend to generally find it unproblematic?
Well, what did 50 Cent tell you? Why did he find it unproblematic?
I mean,
you know,
yeah.
Why ask me? You had 50 Cent in the studio.
Right.
Well, what was his answer, Sean?
Oh, yeah. No, it's a good question. I mean, I think it was just something he was just kind of saying and sort of lapsing into interview speak. And unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to follow up at the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you see, the question of why they don't, and, you know, quote unquote, why artists are comfortable with that,
yeah,
it presupposes that they shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly feel that way, right? But there's a politics to that position that has been at the core of African American musical creativity for a very long time. That is the assumption that Black music and creativity and language and speech and art and culture has existed without societal support, embrace overall, with limited resources, with an ongoing narrative of disrespect, disregard, and non-canonical inclusion,
mm-hmm,
for centuries, right?
Yeah.
So what happens is then it develops a consciousness of resistance, that is to say that it's operating outside the norm and in opposition to this thing called a mainstream that is racist or classist or whatever it is, sexist, etc.
Mm.
And the Black culture somehow survives in a resistive way. But when it becomes deeply complicit with that mainstream market culture, now we have a conflict, right? Because you can't make the claim you have historically made about the form and everything African Americans do being resistant. And so now you have to have a more developed politics. It can't just be, is it mainstream or is it black? Or is it outside the mainstream or inside the mainstream? Now you have to say, what does it mean to be a person who wants to forge an artistic relationship to the black tradition? What type of person are you trying to be? And what kind of art are you trying to create? And the big deal right now is that most are trying to make money, most importantly.
Right.
And making money is not the equivalent of being an artist, shocking though that may seem. Right? And that's really where the rub is. So that's the answer to that, right? That's where the money is. And that's the story he knew, and that's what he got elevated doing in the case of 50 Cent. But even more importantly, corporate forces make it almost impossible for artists not to pick the most profitable tracks, the most profitable directions in their work, which tends to feed this incredible safari. That's a great metaphor.
Yeah.
Safari-like relationship. And that is what we've in many ways conceded in this thing called the post-civil rights era. We've conceded that we're still operating with incredibly in-depth racial stereotype and fantasies, and now that there's more money in it, more people are participating. There's no shame in that game nearly as much as there used to be,
right.
And there's way more money in it. And how can you tell a kid who is not just broke, but societally structured to be broke for life, right? And very likely so broke that he can barely survive. How can you tell him that being that broke is better than performing a fantasy?
Right. Right,
it's very hard to sell that to a child or a young person in the moment. But that's why the I has to be tethered to a we. Because on the I level, there's no argument. I can't really tell them. I can't say. But when you look at it in a we context, and you look at it collectively, and you say, this is what happens to all, several million of us if we go this route. Now it looks wholly different, and I think it's a little bit easier. There's a kind of safety in numbers. There's a vision that emerges. You can rely on one another to create alternatives, but that's much harder to do now. Much harder.
Yeah. Somewhere in that last answer, you talked about various forms of black music, not meeting with sort of mainstream acceptance, canonical acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely mentioned that, particularly in hip hop wars, you talked about past black music forms, as soon as they were no longer strictly for the youth, then they started to move, their movement towards being accepted and making it into more mainstream spaces. Do you see this happening, or is it already happening in rap? After all, it's being taught, as you know, at universities, right? It's on the pop charts. It has, at this point, its old in its own oldies circuits, its own revivalists and classicists and things like that.
Yeah. Well, it'd be fascinating. People tell me, what do you think? Is hip-hop dead? And I say, no, I don't think it has to die, but it can't stay the youth music for the next six generations of youth. That's antithetical to the principle of youth music, which is that each generation or two, uses the tools around them to generate something else. And we want that diversity of life, and that's certainly happening. So I think that will take place. I don't think this can go on forever. But it is a new moment, Sean. It's not the same moment when gospel comes out of the blues, mostly outside of major market influence and power, right? Now we're talking about forms that barely have a chance to exist before they're sucked up into a machinery and an apparatus for commodification that is just overwhelming.
Yeah.
And this is true for all creativity. And I'm not saying there's not an upside to that. There's an upside. You get bigger markets. People hear your music in favelas in Brazil overnight, and there's the internet, and there's a lot of incredible synergy that this kind of space can create. And it can be amazingly powerful, creative, and beautiful. But there's a huge set of risks, downsides, and problems that it produces that we just haven't developed a language and a commitment to fighting. So that's what I get worried about, that, hip-hop wouldn't, in a sense, die a natural death from as a youth music, not a death as an art form, but as a youth music, but that it's sort of on perpetual distorted life support, right?
Yeah.
So that it can be mined for its organs and for its guts and then left to die, right? Not thought of carefully and seriously and respected and revered and challenged and interrogated. And that's a very sad thing to me that would mirror the history of the study and, you know, treatment of African-American music and culture, unfortunately.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sounding really depressing. Don't ask me a happy question.
Yeah, no kidding.
I know. I mean, I'm even getting depressed. I'm talking, for goodness sake.
Yeah. One kind of slightly lighter topic, maybe,
okay.
although it has...
You ask me all the time.
In the hip-hop wars, you talk about how if Tupac were around now, he might be thought of as a conscious rapper or a political guy, or maybe even a little bit soft. I was, and it sounds so crazy to think of the guy with the Thug Life tattoo on his belly, you know, being thought of as, you know, not hardcore in some way. I was just curious if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tupac, I mean, I love Tupac. I think he's, you know, an amazing figure. And I'm very, you know, he also evokes a lot of sadness in me. It's not just his death, but he was more, I feel, emotionally honest about the traps that he was in.
Mm-hmm.
And he was closer to being honest about the real downside to both performing and valorizing Thug Life as much as he was into performing it as well, right? And
yeah.
So he was able to move across those spaces and seemingly express every now and then a genuine worry and concern about, you know, young people as his base, as his fans, but also as his people. He had a consciousness of there being a group of people about whom he had something to consider, right? And things to worry about and wonder about. And I just think that, you know, some of that's really been lost. I'm not saying all of it, but it has not all been lost. There are extraordinary artists who continue to do that, but not with the same visibility that Tupac did it.
Yeah.
And again, that was sort of a transition moment, which is something. Again, it could be temporary, and all of this could end, and we could end up in a whole new formation. And I hope so. But Tupac, to me, spoke to Black suffering from a vantage point that would very much read like a Black radical take on inequality, if you were to put it alongside what I generally hear in the most mainstream articulations of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm. And thus he'd be pegged as like that political guy.
Yeah, exactly. The poet, right? The kind of, you know, progressive, or the person who's talking about Blackness and Black suffering. I mean, just think about how much narrative there is about the ghetto without talking about it being about segregation and class oppression. I mean, why do we have ghettos? I mean, people talk about the ghetto like Black people invented the ghetto, like it's a cultural space
right. That
happens when you put Black people somewhere. I mean, it's like, well, how do we get them? Oh, you mean structural racism? Oh, you mean chronic unemployment and joblessness and you know, housing discrimination and tax resource allocation from white flight for 30 years? Oh, that's how we get them. Okay. So, you know, so it's like this thing that Tupac had a sense of that, and comes out of a tradition in his own family that was acutely aware of that. And so it was inside of his narrative. And of course, he had such a fascinating set of contradictions about women that he spoke the whole range of types of feelings that many men, not all men, have.
Yeah.
And so there was a sensitivity to him that, you know, again, would make him conscious in that way, in my mind.
Right. Excellent. Well, you know, I could talk to you all day. Just a couple more things. In Black Noise, you have this quote about, you say, you know, you're talking specifically about the, you know, concerts and insurance and all that kind of stuff. You talk about the complex web of institutional policing to which rappers are subjected. Now, of course, a few years after you wrote the book, that would turn into literal policing with, you know, what became known as the hip-hop cops in New York City and elsewhere. How did you react when you first heard about that?
I was, you know, what I usually am, sort of, you know, shocked and then not so shocked. Like, why am I, like, a moment of shock, and then you're like, oh, well, that actually completely follows from what they've been doing. And then I wasn't shocked, right? So, you know, I guess what really shocks me the most is not the role of the police force in sort of institutionalizing and using the music to justify what was already a police state-like form of behavior among cops and policies, but actually the fact that there was so little public outcry. So, I mean, this is my point about why commodification can be so dangerous. It means artists can't afford to say anything that might lose some sales.
Right.
So what they can't say is, hey, my community is being jailed and policed and surveilled and, you know, mistreated in ways that are unprecedented and unacceptable. And they should be on MTV talking about it, and they should be on BET. And given the internet, they should be all over the internet. I mean, can you imagine if the top 10 most visible / successful hip-hop artists held a forum on this?
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine that. Of course, that's what Chuck D would have done in 1989.
Right.
So, you know, call me old school. But, I mean, do it in a new school way. Do it on Twitter. I mean, I don't care how you do it. But how can it be that the people who know this situation the best and who have the artistic gifts and have the financial resources don't seem to... aren't able to talk about it? You know, tell professors. So here's my shout out to all of those artists. If you can't do it, call Michael Aaron Dyson. Call me if you wish. Call, you know, the biggest names, people who study hip hop, whoever they are, and give them the information confidentially. Okay, I'll publish it. I'll say, you know, unnamed sources. You know, get it out there. You know, people need this information. You know, our freedom isn't a guarantee. It's every day being eroded. And art is such a powerful source for us. And artistic icons are so important to who we are. And I just want to encourage people to play a little bit more of a role using their genius, not just for, you know, personal fantasy, but, you know, but for the common good.
Okay. And finally, I read somewhere, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but you're working on a new project about African-American artists and musicians and their relationship to justice and community. That was the blurb I read. Can you give us a little bit, tell us a little bit about it?
Well, you know, it's sort of where we started out. The idea behind it, although right now it's tabled temporarily, it's not permanently tabled, but the principle behind it is where we started out when I said, you know, the I and the we, right, the call and response as well as the idea of the individual in community in dialogical relationship crafts a worldview. It sets the stage for shaping a political social consciousness. It's not just that you have a consciousness and then the music mirrors it. It's that the creation of ideas generates consciousness. So what I'm interested in is looking at artists all the way from writers and playwrights to musicians to poets who have a really advanced vision in a way that is particularly powerful along the lines that I've been talking all along here today with you.
Yeah.
To see if we could sort of almost bottle it, you know, sort of instead of seeing all of these disparate artists who are functioning in different fields, like, you know, Hansberry and Tony K. Bambara and Jill Scott and Baldwin and, you know, Lupe Fiasco and, you know, whomever, right? But instead of seeing them as wholly separate spaces, to say, well, what do they share? What ways of understanding community and love as a political gesture and strategies for survival, but also strategies for resistance and change and strategies for creation, you know, what do they share? And how can we make sure that those voices have a bigger place in our imagination?
Wow, and this will take the form of a manuscript, or you're not...
Oh, it only knows on what form it will take. You know, it might just take the form of this podcast. No, I'm kidding. I don't have any idea. It'll be in writing. I mean, that's what I do mostly, is write and speak. So I'm sure it won't be a rap record, though.
Leave that to Cornel West.
Yeah, I'm going to leave that to Cornel West, to you, to Nas, to a whole lot of other people.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. And thank you for your work. And thank you for talking to us. And I hope to con you at some point into getting a verified account on Rap Genius so we can hear, you know, directly what you have to say about different songs.
All right. Well, let's talk about it. Okay. So thanks a lot for what you're up to. I appreciate you taking it all seriously.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Rap Genius is dedicated to decoding, annotating, and analyzing hip-hop lyrics. Join us next week when we talk to Brother Ali about his new album, the meaning of the word terrorism, and lots more. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is hosted and written by Sean Sitaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. To make sure you never miss an episode of the show, please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can reach me with your thoughts about Outside the Lines via Twitter. I'm at Same Old Sean. That's S-H-A-W-N. This podcast was recorded by Sean Sitaro and engineered by Brian Penny at the beautiful Three Egg Studios in Brooklyn, New York. Our show's intern is Sunny Kahara. Intro and outro music by Psionic. Interlude music by Sir Loin. I'm your host, Same Old Sean, and I'll see you next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.